Liz, Black Swans. You're out of the office early. Flex time is one of the perks of the back office inspector's rank these days. And go home to get changed for your date with Dorothy. Not that you're flustered or anything. If your life was a house, she'd merely be the unexploded bomb ticking away in the wreckage of your cellar, capable of blowing you all the way to Oz at any moment. You rush home and dive into the kitchen for a glass of wine, only to stare in dismay at the dirty plates in the kitchen sink. Dive into the bathroom for a quick shower, only to stare in dismay at your haystack hair in the mirror. Dive into the bedroom for a fresh outfit, only to stare in dismay at the contents of the wardrobe, two stale party frocks, various jeans and tees, and at least 8 neatly laundered business suits and accompanying blouses. This is your life, and there's no rug big enough to sweep it all under. At least, not in the half-hour you've allowed yourself for doing the Clark Kent Superman phone booth thing before you rush out again. So you compromise on a glass of water, your hair savagely brushed and tied back to conceal the creeping anarchy and split ends, a different trouser suit, earrings and a necklace that'd get you sent home from the station in disgrace if you wore them on shift, just to remind you that you're off duty. Before you go out, you stare at the bathroom unit uncertainly, reflecting. You spent 20 minutes rushing around like a schoolgirl on a first date, and to what end? It's not like Dorothy doesn't know what you are. Faking soft edges will cut no ice. The thought's meant to count, isn't it? Or the gesture? You're dressing up for her, or not dressing up for her. You're old enough that you ought to know your own mind. You've been kicked in the teeth by love often enough that you should have figured out who you are by now. But you've fallen into an existential trap with this vocation of yours, haven't you? It's easy to know how you're meant to function when you wear a uniform. You do the job and follow the procedures, and everyone knows what you're meant to be doing. What you wear dictates how you behave. But there's no uniform for a date with Dorothy. You panic and get changed again, and in the end you make yourself late enough that you end up calling a taxi, sitting twitchily on the edge of the grey and orange seat as it grumbles uphill towards George Street. It bumps across the guided busway that bisects Queen Street and chugs up Dundas Street, wheezing to a halt at the corner. You pay up and climb out, and a trio of mini-skirted girls nearly stab you to death with their stilettos as they stampede to get in. Just another night out on the tiles in Old Reeky. Nothing to see here but a single 30-something woman in sensible shoes walking towards a wine bar full of braying bankers. Dorothy has found a stool at the bar and is sitting with her back to you, nursing a caipirinha and keeping a quiet watch on the huge mirror behind the bar. Stylish as ever, she makes you feel like a gawky schoolgirl just by existing. You make eye contact through the looking glass, and she gives a little wave of invitation as you walk towards her, a flick of the wrist. Then she's turning, smiling, and you embrace self-consciously. She smells of lavender water. "Hey, darling, you're looking gorgeous. How are you keeping?" "I'm good. Yourself?" You step back, find there's a gap in the row of bar stools, but the next one over is already occupied by a bloke who's the spitting image of a kiddie fiddler you helped put away 10 years ago. Only 10 years younger, of course. You turn away from him hastily as Dorothy's smile opens up like the sun, and she waves past you, attracting the barman's hypnotized gaze. "I'm in town for the next 2 weeks." She runs a hand through her hair, which is a deeper chestnut red than it was the last time you saw her, and about 10 centimetres longer. "Visiting the cage at Gargaburn for an ongoing evaluation at the bank. Then I've got a spot evaluation on some American company's local operation." The cage is the secure zone within the National Bank of Scotland campus. Dorothy is an auditor, the kind who gets to travel a lot. Her little black dress is more boardroom than cocktail bar. doubtless her briefcase and jacket are waiting in the cloakroom, but with her string of pearls and porcelain complexion she could make it work anywhere. They've stuck me in a tedious hotel in the West End. Julian is in Moscow this month, so of course... She raises a meticulously stenciled eyebrow at you. We can see about that. The barman pauses in front of you. White wine spritzer, please, you tell him, and flash your ID badge before he can card you. You wait until he delivers before continuing. Have you eaten yet? No, but there's a place round the corner that's been getting good reviews. She looks at you speculatively. Do you have any plans? Outside of work? You can't help yourself. You have to ask. I don't know yet. For a moment she looks uncertain. This is an odd one. You catch the warning before she continues. I may have to put in lots of overtime. I was hoping we could catch up if the job permits. Dorothy's always like this. Babs accused you of being married to the job, and she wasn't wrong, but Dorothy makes you look like a slacker. That alone would be enough to make your relationship with her an on-again-off-again thing, and that's before you get round to thinking about Julian, her primary. So you nod, hesitantly. I don't have a lot on in the evenings this week, and I'm free Saturday and Monday. Is there anything particular you want to do? Theatre? Music? I was hoping we could start by finding somewhere for dinner. She bites her lip. And then I'd like to pick your brains about a little problem I've got at work. Dorothy is indeed staying in a boring business hotel in the West End. You end up in the bar around midnight by way of a sushi restaurant and a couple of rounds of margaritas. You're not sure whether you're meant to play predator or prey here. It's been months since the last time your paths intersected, but you've got a plushly padded booth to yourselves, and you catch her stealing sly glances at you in the mirror while she's at the bar ordering a round. I can't stay too late. I'm on shift tomorrow, you tell her regretfully as she sits down opposite and bends forward to peel off her pumps. She curls her lower lip, pointedly not pouting. That's a shame, she says. You freeze, outwardly expressionless, as her unshod left foot comes into contact with the inside of your right calf. Question answered. Didn't you say you're free Saturday? You catch your breath. Yes, I am. Actually, clearing weekend leave usually takes advance notice, but you're on weekday office hours right now. You can swing Saturday and Monday if you need to. Maybe even swap Sunday for Monday. Her stockinged foot caresses your ankle. It's smooth, muscular, all those hours in hotel health clubs, reminding you, rubbing. That's assuming I don't get roped into the latest mess. She shows you her teeth. What could possibly be more important than next Saturday? She's playing with you. If her own job demanded it, she'd stand you up in a split second. I thought nothing ever happened in innovative crime. Have they got you back on CID? She pulls back her foot, leaving you tingling. The day before yesterday, I was on a community team assignment and got called in on what turned out to be homicide. Not your usual Ned-on-Ned stabby action. More like Tarantino meets Dali. Wow! Her eyes widen. Why are you here, then? She nudges your foot again, but this time it's an accident, not enemy action. Because after I corralled the witness and set up the incident room, CID turned up and took all my toys away. You shrug. Not that I've got a problem with that. I don't need an extra helping of crap to top up my regular workload. But Dickie, we're on Chatham House rules here, aren't we? She nods. He's the big swinging dick on the investigation, and he's your classic narrow-focus, results-oriented, overdriven alpha male prick. He's treating it as a regular crime, and he's looking for a suitable perp. Which is normally best practice and the right thing to do, except I happen to know that there was a death in another jurisdiction around the same time, and it bears significant points of similarity. All of which scream meme at me, internet meme, class one, virulent. Only Tricky Dicky doesn't want to know. Oi! Dorothy leans back and takes a deep breath, then raises her glass. I didn't hear any of that, I take it. No, of course not. You nod at her. What's your sob story? Work. She pulls the face. Another bloody ethics compliance audit. You walk in the door and everyone gets defensive, like they expect you to put them on a ducking stool and accuse them of witchcraft or something. Ethics. It's not just next door to Suffolk anymore. It's feeble, and she's heard it 1,000 times, but it still raises a smile. Dorothy's job is an odd one, catching corporate corruption before it metastasizes and infects society at large. After Enron collapsed, while you were still in secondary school, the Americans passed the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, accounting regulations for catching corporate malfeasance. But all they were looking for was accounting irregularities, symptoms of maladministration. The unspoken ideology of capitalism didn't admit, back then, of any corporate duty beyond making a return on investment for the shareholders while obeying the law. Then the terrible teens hit, with a global recession followed by a stuttering shockwave of corporate scandals, as rock-ribbed enterprises were exposed as hollow husks, run by conscience-free predators who were even less community-minded and altruistic than gangsters. The ravenous supermarket chains had gutted the entire logistic and retail sector, replacing high street banks and post offices as well as food stores and gas stations, recklessly destroying community infrastructure. Manufacturers had outsourced production to the cheapest overseas bidders, hollowing out the middle-class incomes on which consumer capitalism depended. The prison industrial complex, higher education, and private medical sectors were intent on milking a public purse that no longer had a solid tax base with which to pay. Maximizing short-term profit worked brilliantly for sociopathic executives looking to climb the promotion ladder, but as a long-term strategy for stability, a spiraling Gini coefficient left a lot to be desired. The European Parliament responded by focusing on corporate governance. If corporations wanted to be legal citizens, the politicians riding the backlash declared, they could damned well shoulder the responsibilities of good citizenship as well as the benefits. Social as well as financial audits were the order of the day. Directives outlining standards for corporate citizenship were drafted, and a lucrative niche for a new generation of management consultants emerged. Those who could look at an organization and sound a warning if its structure rewarded pathological behavior. And as for the newly nationalized supermarket monopolies, a flourishing future as government-owned logistics hubs beckoned. After all, with no post offices, high street banks, or independent general stores, who else could do the job? It's a bank. Dorothy shrugs. We're running a 3-year review for them, focusing on human resources, internal promotion practices, and how they monitor compliance with social policy directives for dealing with customers in default. Defaults are a political hot potato in this deflationary age. The ground still hasn't stopped shaking from the collapse of the noughties investment bubble, and only government intervention has stopped Scotland and the other Western EU members following America down the road of mass repossessions, Greenspan favelas, and civil unrest. Bankers aren't stupid this decade. They know what happened to their predecessors. What we're worrying about is getting to the next decade's managers before they unlearn the lesson, and there's some other stuff, but I can't talk about that." Her mention of other stuff is uncharacteristically low-key, and you know Dorothy well enough to have a clue what makes her tick. Usual rules. Cross your heart and hope to spontaneously combust, more like. "Well?" You take a lick of salt from the rim of your glass, roll your tongue at her. "We can see about that." "I'm serious." Her lips pale. "So am I. What do you think would happen if I compromised a live intelligence-led investigation?" "Translation. Why do you want to tell me this?" "Much the same." She looks at you for a moment. "Is your phone on? Remove the battery." You stare at her. Then you reach into your handbag and take out your phone and pop the back of the case. There's a camera behind the bar. It's overlooking the till, but it can see the mirror. "I know. I checked earlier. It's high def, but we're far enough away that it won't record a good enough picture for lip reading, and we're less likely to be overheard here." She pulls out her own phone and removes the battery. You suddenly feel as naked as you've ever been with her. "You didn't look me up just for old time's sake," you accuse. "Not entirely." She doesn't try to look away. "I'm sorry. Yes, I have an ulterior motive. I need a sanity check, Liz."
"A sanity check? Banking ethics isn't my..."
"This isn't about banking. You're on my disclosure notice. Nobody's going to think twice about me hooking up with a girlfriend." The indefinite article stings, a reminder of where you stand with Dorothy. "Disclosure notice. I'm not sure I like the sound of that." She waves it off. "It's a sealed declaration of interests for the enhanced background inquiry, so I can't be blackmailed. It's basically just an enhanced CRB check with extras, Liz." She pauses. "You're not in the closet. I mean at work, are you?"
"Not for years."
"Good. Look, what I'm concerned about is that nobody's likely to listen in on this, and anybody who notices us here is going to assume the obvious." She slides her leg against your knee again. "Oh, yes. I'm looking forward to Saturday." "Are you?" Her eyes are gleaming. You focus on her lips, glossy and plump with anticipation and shiver. "If I were a man, I'd call you a cocktease." You manage to summon up something not unlike a coy smile. "I'd like to take you upstairs after this drink, but I think my room's probably bugged." She says it so casually, it takes you a moment to understand her words. "I can understand if you don't want that. Listening in, I mean." It's like a bucket of cold water in the face. "Who's bugging you?" "I'm not entirely sure. It goes back about 2 months. I ran across some rather weird correlations when I was going over the transactions for..." "Never mind. Anyway, my boss buried my email and reassigned me when I tried to raise it with him last month. Said it was circumstantial and we didn't have the resources to go after random leads. Well, I've been doing some more digging, and when I got here, I found a concealed camera in my bedroom and one in the shower. There's a famous optical illusion, a silhouette of a vase which, once you know what to look for, suddenly flips into a silhouette of two faces looking at each other, or vice versa. You're looking at Dorothy's face, and one moment you could have sworn she's excited, turned on, and the next she's frightened. Context is everything. "What do you think's going on?" you ask her. She shoves her glass to one side of the table and leans forward. "I can't tell you the details, but part of what we do is abstract social network analysis on waves, IM, email, phone calls, looking for indicators of pathological communications patterns.
If you can track who's talking to who, you can work out which parts of an organization work together and see emergent patterns of behavior. It goes back to the classic study on Enron's email corpus in the noughties, but there's been a lot of work since then on agent-assisted NLP and transitive clique identification. There's also some promising work on determination of ethical or conspiratorial networks. There are other data sets we can trawl exhaustively. The banking crisis, the full corpus of internal communications left behind in the wake of the Goldman Sachs collapse. All the data sets from businesses we've audited since the corporate responsibility criteria were introduced, suitably blinded and anonymized. We use them to spot warning signs. You get a different pattern of communication in groups who are colluding to instigate a cover-up, for instance. At this point, you're working hard to keep your eyes open. Dorothy would have made a kick-ass accountant if she hadn't decided to go into corporate psychoanalysis. She could bore for Europe in the Olympics if she wanted to. But you ken where she's going with this. It's not so dissimilar to what you do in the Innovative Crime Investigation Unit, which, come to think of it, is how you met her in the first place, at a conference on preemptive gang crime prevention. What did you find? What got my attention is the bank I'm here to audit. I got an anonymous tip to look into something and, well, there's a pattern of communication in their investment arm that looks worryingly similar to some of the craziest stuff that was going on in 2007. Subprime investments, dangerous quant stuff. Unethical, if not illegal. Only it's not real estate this time, Liz. I pulled the audit trail, and it turns out they're investing heavily in options trades based on government bonds from a breakaway republic in the back end of Asia. What's alarming me is, round about 2009, one of the things that happened during the Great Recession was that banks almost universally ran out of liquidity all over the world simultaneously. It got to the point where national regulators started turning a blind eye when their banks accepted deposits in cash from, irregular sources. Money laundering. Some say up to a third of $1 trillion in black money was laundered into the global banking system during the crash. It was the last hurrah of the great drugs cartels. Decriminalization and the dollar collapse effectively bankrupted them over the next decade. But ending the war on drugs didn't end organized crime, and there are still gangs out there with money to launder. Anyway, I got a tip-off, began looking for signs of weirdness in the money supply in the Republic of Issyk-Kulistan. We've got far less data on them than on our own banks, but I didn't have to look hard. If they're so poor and they've got a 40% unemployment rate, how come their GDP rose 30% on independence? Anyway, I took it to my line manager, and he told me to lay off. It's all inconclusive, and anyway, it's outside our purview. Drop it completely, in other words. Then I got sent up here to do a routine audit, and it turns out that my hotel room's bugged. Also, I think I spotted a man following me yesterday. On the tram, home from work. I never thought I'd say this, but I'm scared, Liz. There's a time to stand on your work-slash-life balance metric, and a time to throw the rulebook out the window. Dorothy is clearly frightened. So scared it took her 3 cocktails and a presumptively bug-free bar to open up to you. Unfortunately, a lot of what she told you is as confidential as the contents of your own ongoing investigations, i.e., it's a honking great disciplinary, or even criminal, offence to talk about it out of school. Not to mention, reeking of some kind of artificial reality game to anyone who doesn't know that she really is a chartered social pathology analyst who works for the Department of Trade and Industry's Ethical Oversight Inspectorate. A fancy way of saying she's a canary in the kind of coal mine where they call a serious fraud office to deal with the cave-ins. So, despite being off duty, you put the battery back in your phone and file in quick succession an open case report, female reports being trailed by unidentified male, with a note that this is subject to investigation under the Protection from Harassment Act. A note for the intelligence desk, subject reports threatening behaviour due to sensitive nature of employment they suspect a possible violation of Whistleblower Protection Act. And finally, a memo to yourself. Look into organised crime / connection with Issyk Kulistan. Which you will probably offload onto Mox's overflowing to-do heap on the morrow. The latter might be treading dangerously close to misuse of police resources for personal gain, but your soft shoe shuffle, if anyone asks, will revolve around a third-party tip-off about persons of interest to an ongoing organised crime investigation in another force area. At worst, the skipper will yell at you and deliver his number 3 not getting distracted lecture again. All of which adds up to this. If Dorothy needs to talk to a control room officer in a hurry, they'll clock her cop space trail, realise that a detective inspector's taking her concerns seriously, and listen. Probably. Which is the sort of thing that sometimes saves lives, and certainly you'll sleep a wee bit more soundly for knowing she's safe under the watching eyes of your colleagues. "That's filed," you tell her, and yawn. "Are you going to be okay for the new?" "I'll have to be," she smiles shakily as she stands up. "I'll not be asking you to come up to my room." She rolls her eyes in the direction of the camera dome behind the bar, and you don't have the heart to remind her that for everyone she can see, there'll be at least 2 that she doesn't. "Saturday. Your place?" You stand up too. "It's yours. If you want to come back with me tonight." She leans forward, and of an instant you're hugging each other. Her breath is hot against your neck. "Better not," she murmurs. "If I'm really being watched, I'm contagious. All the same, I'm going to check into a different hotel tomorrow and hope it throws them, whoever they are." "Sounds like a good idea." "I think so. So, are we on for the weekend?" "If you want." She turns her head, kisses you hard on the mouth. You swallow a gasp, suddenly acutely aware that you're in public. Then she pulls back, leaving your lips tingling. "Yes, I want. Good night, darling." Her smile is a fey thing. It fades as she walks towards the lobby, leaving you standing by the table, your nipples tight, your breath stolen, and your head full of harm. Anwar, diplomat. Over the next 4 days, you fall into a comfortable workday pattern. Get out of bed, go to the bathroom, and get dressed and go downstairs to the kitchen, where Bibi has just about finished getting the breakfast down the bairns before she heads out to sign into the pharmacy at the Leithwalk Tesco. You drink a glass of tea, eat your muesli, grab your phone, and kiss Bibi goodbye. From your front door, it's 20 minutes to the office on foot, or, if it's pishing down, 30 minutes by way of a quick dash to a shelter and a long wait for the tram. Not much happens at the office. A couple of times a day, some chancer rings your buzzer, wanting a bag of bread mix and a novelty tourist brochure. You've got a stack of the things in a cardboard display by the door. They cycle tiredly through a grayscale slideshow of yaks, yurts and tractor factories. The Ministry of Tourism's budget doesn't stretch to colour e-ink, let alone hiring a photographer to update their archive footage. You sadistically abuse the rubber plant whenever you can be bothered and expense a couple of big colour picture frames for the wall, loaded with the least kitsch corners of the Ministry's wallpaper archive, mostly mountains and mosques, to make it look more like an authentic consulate. On day three, a certain existential anime sets in. So you amuse yourself with your bootleg phone and specs. You pull down your favourite procedural wallpaper from the cloud and overlay the bare, beige office walls with a gigantic play space hosting an improbable orgy-themed mash-up from XXX-Men and Backroom Boys. It's machinima-generated real-time porn, and you don't want to look at their faces for too long, or you'll get creeped out by the inbred uncanny valley features. But all that pumping and writhing and sucking is a good distraction from the fact that is slowly sneaking up on you. You're bored. Here you are in your good business suit, sitting at a desk in the consulate, prim and proper as can be, like a maiden aunt haunted by fantasies of debauchery. And there's nothing to fucking do. Welcome to boredom space. Since you hung out your shingle, you've entertained one visiting trade delegation, six assorted shifty-eyed locals in search of a loaf, two adventurous backpackers, a yak milk importer looking to make an end run round EU animal husbandry regulations, and seven confused visitors looking for the games company upstairs. There are, of course, the language lessons. On your own initiative, you've expensed a set of Rosetta Stone courseware on Kyrgyz, and you're trying to spend half an hour a day on it. But you've never had much of a knack for language study. You keep tripping over the Cyrillic alphabet, and the spoken tongue sounds like you're gargling rusty nails, and leaves your throat feeling like it too. Google Translate doesn't handle Kyrgyz very well. Luckily, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs conducts all their correspondence in mangled English. You really wouldn't bother, except for a nagging sense that at the next interview, it might be good to know what they're saying behind your back. In the end, you find yourself reading the small print on the back of a bag of bread mix and thinking about what the gnome said about home brew. Shite beer, he'd said, unless you add cofactor. Well, it's not like you know a lot about brewing to begin with, is it? So you hop on the web and, at considerable risk to your soul, begin searching for websites dedicated to the unclean pursuit. When the buzzer goes off, you're queasily engrossed in an account of certain jail cell antics involving buckets, sugar, yeast, and unspeakable contaminants. The things Neds will do to get off their heads. You jump, swear quietly, and hit the entry phone button. Come in. You're standing up when the door opens. Your visitor is probably white underneath the grime, walks with an odd shuffle, and could benefit from a shower and a session at a launderette. He's probably about 20 and painfully thin. You smile politely. Welcome to the Issyk Kulistan Consulate, sir. Would you mind stating your name and business?
I'm Jaxi. I canny hingy your bag of bread mix, Lexi.
Oh, he's one of them. You nod sympathetically, walk over to the trunkful of insect-free fair trade organic bread mix barley rye, and pull out a bag. One of these, you ask, remembering to breathe through your mouth as you approach him.
Gimme that thing of me.
He makes a lunge for the bag, and you pull it away from him. He wears no specs, which is probably a good thing. He doesn't look like the type to appreciate the panting contents of the leather sling he's standing in front of in porn space. You know how to use it, right? You stare at him. You know about the cofactor? What is it? Jaxi stares at you in confusion.
What?
The stuff you add to the bread mix when you're making beer. What is it?
What? I didn't ken your accent, man. What you wantin'?
What have you been told to add to this when you brew? You hold the bag up. Jax's eyes track the bag like a dog hoping for a treat. oblivious to the gamin sailor boy and the pair of huge leather bears making out lasciviously at his feet.
Hingme? Oh, that!
He produces a small glass bottle of tablets from somewhere in his Swiss Army jacket. You peer at the label. Selenium.
Get it at Holland and Barrett, like, say. Fucking eppies.
Very good. You smile ingratiatingly and hand over the bread mix. Don't do anything with it that I wouldn't do. You wink at the virtual marine who's rubbing his crutch on Jax's leg and show him the door. Dietary supplements, right? The virtual marine is strangling the one-eyed trouser python and making calf eyes at you. Annoyed, you kill the wallpaper and drop back into beige-walled boredom space. Fucking hippies! You sit back down at the desk and go back to reading up on home brewing. Maybe, you reflect, jailhouse recipes aren't the best way forward. You're a lucky man in many respects. You have a house, a genuine, authentic house with its own roof, not a tenement, an adoring wife with a respectable and moderately lucrative profession, and two bouncing children who squeal with delight when they see you, although of late you could swear that Nassim is holding back a little, in a faint foreshadowing of adolescent male surliness. You also have two aunts, an uncle, a mother-in-law, six assorted grandparents, a vast and inchoate clan of in-laws and first cousins and nieces and nephews, and other more distant relations whose precise proximity to your bloodline can only be expressed algebraically. What you don't have is privacy. Privacy is a luxury. To buy it, you need to be able to buy space and fit locks, to switch off the phone and live without fear of dependency on others. Privacy is a peculiarly 20th century concept, an artifact of the Western urban middle classes. Before then, only the super rich could afford it, and since the invention of email and the mobile phone, it's largely slipped away. Not that you normally need privacy. Your home life is happily lived in the presence of others. It's not as if you don't share a bed with your wife or put up with her mother popping round for a bag of rice and a sink-side chat every day. The other corners of your life you discreetly hide away in public houses and public toilets, although, to be perfectly truthful, the latter make you increasingly nervous. You've begun to pick your partners for their bedroom decor as much as their looks. Still, once in a while you want to bring something home with you without attracting Bibi's attention or the Ben's curiosity, and so it's time to go up to the loft again. When you bought, or more accurately inherited, the house, you knew it had a loft, but not much more. When you first got up there, you weren't impressed. But since then you've fitted DIY insulation and nailed it down with boards and carpet tiles so you can walk around. A loft ladder followed, and LED lighting tiles and mains outlets. You're hoping soon to have enough cash to pay for a dormer window to replace the velux. Bibi doesn't come up here. She doesn't like ladders, gets dizzy, and you've told her it's a storeroom. Which is true up to a point, but you've got a chair and some beanbags and a projection TV and a small fridge for the beer. Before the filth collared you, you kept your water pipe and a stash up here, but you don't want Mr. Weber to get the idea you're living a disorganized lifestyle, so you've reluctantly laid off the skunk. There's also a tin can aerial lined up on Cousin Tariq's roof, an interesting router running firmware he downloaded off the dark side of the net, and a clean pad he gave you to work on when you got out of Nick. But you haven't spent much time up here since you got the new job. That's about to change, isn't it? There's a wee hole-in-the-wall shop just off Easter Road, run by a middle-aged white guy with a straggly beard. Cousin It would probably grunt Ippy on sight, that services the homebrew hobbyists. The shop smells of yeast and hot plastic from the fabber he's got in the back for running up obscure knobbly connectors. Most of the stuff he sells is off the shelf, though. When you walk in, he's deep in conversation with a fat, middle-aged woman with crimson hair, whose unseasonal shaggy black coat makes her look like a tank in the sheep army. You spend a few minutes gawping at the gleaming stainless steel machine. It looks like a dissected automatic washer-dryer that sits in pride of place on the shop counter. It's some sort of German Vorsprung-Durk technique microprocessor-managed brewery in a box. Put in raw materials, select program, leave for a month, drink the output. But you don't have €1,000 to spare for it. Then you poke around the shelves for a bit, hunting for the items on your shopping list. The shopkeeper's still yakking to the woman, who seems to be some sort of local beer monster, and pays no attention to you until you get to the throat-clearing, toe-tapping stage.
"Aye, sir. What can I do you for?"
You ignore the slip of the tongue.
"I need these, and a siphon, and an airlock, I think."
You've been doing your homework, but you're not entirely sure what an airlock looks like until he steps out from behind the counter and produces a transparent plastic hingmy.
"Boiled water goes here," he says, showing you how. "Then you stick it in the bung, like so. If you're just getting started, you might want one of our starter packs. What kind of beer were you after?"
"I've already got one," you say. "A present."
"IPA or lager?" asks the woman, chipping in. "Is it bottom fermenting or top fermenting?"
You look at her blankly. The shopkeeper clocks what's up and none too subtly eyeballs the nosy lass to butt out.
"It's okay," he says quietly. "I've got a starter pack on the website in 5 languages.
He passes you a card. "If you want, I've got a friend who can rent you some cellar space."
"No, no, that won't be necessary," you say hurriedly. "I just need the apparatus."
Obviously he kens the ethnic angle, thinks you're wanting the opportunity to quaff a wee bevy at home with no betraying six-packs.
"Well, that's okay then. $24.96, please."
You hand over the cash and flee, then realise once you're out of the door that you forgot to ask for a bag and you're going home clutching a huge plastic bucket labelled fermentation bin and decorated with pictures of overflowing beer glasses. And he forgot to offer you one. Have these people no shame? Bibi, for a miracle, is in the kitchen when you open the front door. You head upstairs at a dash and hurl the incriminating bucket up the loft steps before she has a chance to see it. You've still got to figure out how to get 20 litres of freshly boiled water up to it and how to keep it warm afterwards, but at least she doesn't have to know about your conducting your filthy haram experiments under her roof. There is, of course, the old electric kettle, if you can remember where it's lurking. It's corroded and leaks alarmingly around the water gauge, but you don't think Bibi threw it out. You clamber down the ladder and go into the kitchen to hunt around. Finally, you think to look in the cellar, where the mains distribution board, the gas meter, and several piles of junk lurk villainously in wait for unshod feet. The kettle is resting under a layer of mouldy plaster dust in one of the slowly deliquescing cardboard boxes. The cellar smells of damp brickwork, and your sinuses clamp shut in protest before you can beat a retreat. Which is why Bibi finds you in the kitchen, clutching a dusty kettle and breathing heavily through your mouth when she bustles in with a wheelie bag full of groceries.
"Help me unpack this," she says breathlessly, then notices the kettle.
"Oh, good,
Are you taking it for recycling?
I need it for the office, you say. Then the breath catches in your throat as a convulsive sneezing fit takes hold.
Achoo!
Not over the sag, you naughty man. She thrusts a wad of tissue at you. This bag needs refrigerating. When you're feeling better. You blink red-rimmed eyes at her. The cellar is damp. Oh, dear, has the dehumidifier filled up again? What dehumidifier? The one we borrowed from Martin, silly. Don't you remember? She looks at you with a speculative expression that puts you in mind of a stableman sizing up an elderly mule for the glue factory. You sigh. Now that she mentions it, you remember her telling you something about dampness and a gadget the old guy next door had offered to loan her. No, I didn't, you admit. You say it's filling up? Yes, she says brightly. It needs emptying once a week. Damp, in the cellar. If Samina's planned to try and hold a family reunion in Lahore to corral everyone into buying into some kind of extended family takeover of a half-completed hotel complex had worked, you wouldn't have a problem with rising damp in the cellar. You might have to dodge the occasional lunatic in explosive corsetry, but it can't be any more risky than running the gauntlet of the random bampots down the foot of the walk on a Saturday night. Alas, you were one of the idiots who balked at the idea of turning to the hospitality trade. Besides, it rains too much there, you moaned at your mother-in-law, regurgitating childhood memories of a June vacation. Oh, the irony! Yes, I think it's getting worse. Your wife tilts her head on one side as she looks at you. What are you going to do about it? You sigh deeply. I'll see if I can round up someone who knows about such things. She hands you a cardboard punnet full of mushrooms. You'd better, or we'll be growing these down there. You help Bibi unpack the groceries that need refrigerating, then retreat upstairs to the bathroom, clutching the kettle. Not being entirely stupid, you wash the filthy thing out in the wash basin, then take it up to the attic and return for a bucket of water, which you manhandle up the ladder precariously with much sloshing and dripping. Finally, you glance at the brew shop's website, where there is indeed a multilingual FAQ. It's in Arabic, Turkish, and Farsi, among other languages, if you recognize the characters correctly. You'll have to settle for English. First, boil 20 litres of water and allow to cool to 40 degrees. You plug the kettle in, fill it up, throw the switch, and all the lights and electrics go out. A few seconds later, you hear Bibi cursing most immodestly downstairs. You're really going to have to tackle the damp now, aren't you? Otherwise, you're never going to hear the end of it. On day 4 of your new occupation, you receive an invitation to a diplomatic reception at the Georgian consulate. Actually, you received it on day 2, or rather your spam filter received it, whereupon it languished in mime-encapsulated limbo until you could be bothered to skim the contents of the mailbox, swear, then freak out and run squawking in circles. You are invited to attend an informal cheese and wine reception at the Georgian Consulate on Brunswick Street on tonight at 7:30 p.m, hosted by the Trans-Caucasian Inward Investment and Tourism Trust, RSVP, etc. After about 15 minutes, you wise up and dash off a hasty query to head office. Should I stay or should I go? You haven't been keeping up with the daily bulletins from the diplomatic service. They are replete with information about yak wool exports, the lemon harvest, and the urgent need to redress the balance of trade deficit, but not so fascinatingly full of matters of statecraft. So you have not the veriest inkling of a clue as to whether the independent republic of Issyk Kulistan is on kissing terms with Georgia, or at war, or something in between. All you really know about politics in the part of the world you represent is that it can be alarmingly personal at times, not to mention bloody-minded, brutal, Byzantine, and any number of other unpleasant adjectives beginning with B. There's no immediate reply, so you call the gnome. Help, you say succinctly. There's a brief, pregnant pause. Help what? I've been invited to a diplomatic reception. Help! You're beyond help, laddie, he sounds amused. You'll just have to fend for yourself. Is it one of the Middle East missions? No, you swallow. It's Georgia. Georgia next to Alabama, or... Oh, I see. Well, you may be in luck, then. They drink alcohol. Just remember not to mention the South Ossetian question, the Transnistrian dispute, Azerbaijani Shiite separatism, or the existence of Abkhazia. You've never heard of any of those places, so you should be able to quaff a free bevy or six and leg it without giving mortal offence. How do you know all this? You ask in something like awe. I looked it up on Wikipedia. Oh, and try to remember, the Russians are not their friends. Have a fun party. Cunt. He hangs up. Cunt isn't an unusual expostulation from the gnome. It's commonly directed at any lucky acquaintance who's gotten to stick their gristle missile in a particularly cute twink and indicates envy rather than ire. Nevertheless, you feel acutely inadequate. It's a shame you can't send the man himself in your place, but he'd probably piss in the punch bowl and start a trade war or something, just to drop you in it. The cunt! There's no reply from the Foreign Ministry, and with a sinking heart you realise it's Thursday afternoon over here and probably closing in on sundown. They'll be knocking off early for Friday. You're on your own. So you apply yourself to wiki-fiddling for a couple of hours of fascinated voyeuristic geopolitical prurience. You had no idea the Arik had such interesting neighbours. Then it's knocking off time for you too, with a few hours to fill until the party. The shortest route to the Brunswick Street Consulate is via Calton Hill and your favourite pub, so you decide to fortify yourself with some water of life and a pita wrap before you nip round and do the James Bond cocktail circuit thing. The gnome isn't in residence at this time. Neither is Olaf, the Norwegian barman you quite fancy. It's still quiet. The Friday night meat market hasn't opened yet. So you sit in a corner and quietly shovel back your ale and chicken tikka wrap. You've got time to borrow a pad, boot an anonymous guest VM, and spend half an hour poking around a somewhat dodgy chat room Tariq introduced you to, one that you're not supposed to go within 1,000 kilometres of during your probation. Maybe because it has something to do with the seamy underside of internet affiliate scheme marketing. But they'd have to swab the screen for DNA to prove you were there. And anyway, you're just looking, aren't you? Right now it's a big disappointment. Nobody seems to be posting there this week. It's like the usual denizens have all gone on holiday. Or been lifted by the polis, more like, you think uneasily, and log out of the anonymous guest account, which goes poofing up to bit-rot heaven. With a sinking heart, you stand and make your way round the hill towards London Road, and thence towards the Georgian consulate, which is itself ensconced in a different kind of Georgian townhouse opposite a row of imposingly colonnaded hotel frontages. Scotland, being one of those odd semi-autonomous states embedded within the EU post-independence and still only semi-devolved from their former parent nation, doesn't rate actual embassies. Nevertheless, the glowing affluence of a real consulate fills you with mild envy. There's a shiny black BMW hybrid in diplomatic plates plugged into the charge point outside the front door, and a flag on a pole sticking out of the second-floor window casement. Not to mention bunting and coloured lights inside the wedged-open front door. A Scottish woman in a trouser suit and expensive eyewear clocks you and smiles professionally.
"Mr. Hussain, we've been looking forward to meeting you. Have you had your tea, then?"
Your ears perk up at this decidedly non-Edinburgh hospitality, but your stomach's been rumbled. You nod.
"Alas, yes, Miss McIntosh. Fee McIntosh."
She beckons you in like an affable praying mantis. She's about 10 centimetres taller than you and looms alarmingly.
"Notary and assistant to the First Consul. That's Dr. Mazniashvili. Won't you come in? We have grape juice, or wine, if you're so inclined."
"There's more than one of you," you ask as she ushers you into a space not unlike a dentist's waiting room, except that the receptionist's counter has been stacked 3 bottles deep in refreshments, and there's a table stacked high with trays of canapés. Several patients sit in chairs around the room or stand in small clusters, talking quietly with pained expressions. You pounce on a tumbler, splash a generous shot of Talisker into it, and raise it. "Your health!" Fee half smiles, then picks up a tall glass full of orange juice.
"Prosit," she replies. "The meat cocktail snacks are halal, by the way."
She takes a sip.
"Yes, there are 4 of us here, but only the First Consul is a Georgian national. I understand you're not actually from Issyk Kulistan yourself."
"No." You glance from side to side. Here you are trapped with a glass of single malt and a red-headed stick insect. What can you say?
"That's to say, there aren't any natives of Issyk Kulistan in Scotland, as far as the Foreign Ministry was able to determine, so they put the job out to tender and ended up hiring me."
"Ah," she nods slowly, "one of those jobs. I don't suppose it's terribly busy, is it?" You suck in your lower lip and clutch your tumbler close.
"No, not really."
She nods again.
"You're the 6th, you know."
"The 6th? 6th what?"
6th pseudo."
She peers at you over the rim of her glasses, which are recording everything and projecting a head-up display on her retinas.
"They offered you a steady job in return for processing forms, notarising documents, sorting out accommodations for distressed natives, and so on, didn't they?"
"I don't see what business of yours my employment is," you say, perhaps a trifle more waspishly than is tactful. She blinks.
"I'm sorry, I didn't mean to intrude."
She nods sidelong at a fellow with a face like the north end of a southbound freight locomotive.
"That's Gerald Williams. He's the honorary consul for the Popular Democratic Republic of St. Lucia.
You might want to look up the constitutional crisis there 7 years ago. They were the first pseudo. In their case, they used to be a real country, albeit a wee one. But after the big hurricane, a consortium of developers literally bought the place, made the population an offer they couldn't refuse, relocate somewhere with better weather and about €10,000 a head. Now it's a shell country, specialising in banking and carbon credit exports. They're still signatory to the climate protocols."
She knocks back her OJ like she's trying to wash away the taste of a dead slug. "They're legit, if shady. I shouldn't really say this, but I hope you double-checked who you were doing business with. One of these days, we're going to see a really nasty pseudo,
and the consequences are going to be unpleasant all round. She smiles tightly. George's celebrating its 30th anniversary later this year, and we're throwing a party. Perhaps you'd like to come.
I'd love to, you manage. What did you do to get this gig, you're about to say? It comes out as, before you worked for the Georgian consulate.
A doctorate in international relations, specialising in the history of the Transcaucasus in the latter half of the 20th century. I did my fieldwork in Tbilisi.
She reaches for the mixers and tops up her OJ, then adds a splash of vodka.
It was this, or move to Brussels. I can do simultaneous translation between English and Kartli, you know.
Her smile broadens.
And yourself?
Rumbled. You shrug. I'm trying to learn Kyrgyz. Badly, you don't add. Nor do you mention that your highest degree is a lower second from the Polytechnic of Real Life, with a postgraduate diploma in Scally Studies from Sochten. And I've got a great line in bread mix samples from the People's No. 4 Grain Products Factory of Issyk Kulistan. Guaranteed insect-free.
So your republic exists primarily to export bread mix to the EU?
She sniffs, evidently amused.
Wait here, Mr. Hussein. I'll be right back.
And with that, she disappears into the front parlour of the Georgian consulate. You amble around the room for a while. The background chatter is getting louder and more visitors are arriving. To your untrained eye, it's impossible to tell whether they're diplomats or art school dropouts, but they seem to know what they're doing, and a high proportion of them look even less Scottish than you. You find yourself chatting to a poet who lives in Pilton, apparently an émigré from Tashkent. If you understand his rapid-fire Turkish-accented Scots dialect correctly, you smile and nod politely and work your way towards the bottom of your tumbler. The world is taking on a rosy glow of bonhomie when Fee, or should that be Dr. McIntosh, returns to the party. As it happens, you've just turned away from your poet to refill your glass, so she heads straight towards you. She's got a small dog-eared paperback in one hand.
"Sorry, ran into a spot of bother in the kitchen," she says unapologetically. "Listen, you're obviously new to all this, and I suddenly remembered I had a book that came in handy when I was getting started, an introductory text."
She pushes it at you with a slightly furtive expression. The penny drops, and you slide it into your jacket pocket and thank her effusively.
"No, really, it's the least I could do. Don't take it too seriously, but you'd be surprised how far it'll take you. It does what it says on the can."
She smiles.
"I'd better circulate now. We're beginning to fill up. See you around."
As she turns away, you risk a quick scooby at the book's cover. On the rebound from the double take, you glare at her receding back. Then remember where you are and whose whiskey you're drinking, and force yourself to calm down. "The Idiot's Pocket Guide to International Diplomacy, indeed. What kind of amateur does she take you for?"